Is Kurdish nationalism a deliberately weaponized instrument of U.S. imperial policy in Syria? In what ways is the plight of the Kurds in northeastern Syria being distorted? Why are revered human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Médecins Sans Frontières aligning with imperial interests in Syria? Who are the Syrians in Canada promoting regime change in their home country? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we deconstruct the various propaganda elements sustaining Western popular support for the U.S.-NATO military interventions in the country. We'll hear Syrian-American political commentator and Mint Press News contributor Sarah Abed debunk the heroic narratives surrounding the Kurdish resistance and their nationalistic ambitions. We'll hear investigative reporter and book author Mark Taliano correct the record on the myth of Assad's war crimes in Syria. And we'll hear a Syrian-Canadian academic, Majd Zuda, discuss the dynamics within the Syrian diaspora that enable the continued propaganda narratives against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. On this week's program, The War on Syria, debunking progressive left narratives. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 27th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In the case of OxyContin, the pills are legal, while heroin is considered a Class A illegal drug. However, heroin and OxyContin are both opiates, or derivatives of opium, which in its unprocessed form is, of course, illegal. Purdue Pharma, which is privately owned by the Sackler family, according to Keefe, has made billions of dollars off of OxyContin. Until recently, Purdue Pharma enlisted its hundreds of sales representatives to convince doctors that OxyContin was not addictive. It also sent physicians who advocated for OxyContin on lavish trips to speak at medical conferences where they would praise the drug and employed other strategies to try and ensure the continued maximum prescribing of the drug. That comes from the article, Pharmaceutical Firm Makes Billions by Fueling Opioid Crisis, by Mark Carlin, posted October 26th. Chemical-intensive green revolution technology and ideology has effectively uprooted indigenous traditional agriculture across the planet and has recast farming according to the needs of global agribusiness and its supply chains. This has had devastating effects on regions, rural communities, diets, soils, health, and water pollution. However, this financially lucrative venture for transnational corporations continues apace, spearheaded by the Gates Foundation in Africa and the World Bank's Enabling the Business of Agriculture. This model of agriculture is poisoning life and the environment and undermining food security throughout the globe. Power is now increasingly concentrated in the hands of a handful of transnational agribusiness corporations, which put profit and market control ahead of food security, health and nutrition, and biodiversity. That comes from the article, Food, Agriculture, and the Global Ecology, Rolling Back the Tide of Pesticide Poison, Corruption, and Looming Mass Extinction, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted October 24th. People getting mass health assume they are getting health insurance. In fact, if they are over 55, they are only getting a loan for health coverage, which they must pay back from their estate, their home, their savings, their personal property, after they die. The process by which the state recovers the cost of your health care coverage is called estate recovery. The low-income people whom MassHealth is supposed to serve may thus be unable to leave the one thing they might have, their family home, to their children. MassHealth does not tell you exactly what health coverage they will be charging your estate for after you die. One must assume it is any and all health care provided. That comes from the article, Medicaid is a Scam, Estate Recovery in Massachusetts, by Richard Hugus, posted October 23rd, originally appearing at richardhugus.wordpress.com. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The realities behind the conflict in Syria may have been concealed behind a propaganda curtain generated in the West. Earlier interviews with Ava Bartlett and Vanessa Beely have exposed the fact that people on the ground have a much different message about their plight that is being actively negated by mainstream news sources. In this program, we're attempting to carry on that conversation. Sarah Abbott is a Syrian-American independent investigative political commentator who focuses on exposing the lies and propaganda in mainstream media news and social media. She's a truth advocate who uses her social media accounts and website, The Rabbit Hole, at www.sarahabbott.com to counter Western media disinformation about Syria. Sarah Abbott, welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Now, The Kurds have gotten a heroic reputation in recent years as a major force of resistance against ISIS-Daesh. How exactly do you see these Kurds aligning with U.S. imperial interests in Syria?
Okay, well, the first aspect I just want to touch on is that historically they have been used in uprisings for the same exact reason. So this isn't the first time that they've been used as pawns or as a tool to destabilize the area or for imperialism. Back in 1965 to 1975, actually, Israel had supported them when they had an uprising against the Iraqis. And the U.S. actually supported them as well, but then they backed out when Iran and Iraq came to an agreement. And they had ended their war. And there were a number of Kurds that actually got massacred as a result of that. So it's kind of interesting that the Kurds are now finding themselves in the same position as they were before. And they're not realizing that the U.S. intends to only use them, you know, to carry out their mission. But then after that, their support kind of is no longer there. So the U.S. is not really interested in, you know, them establishing autonomy or an independent Kurdistan, because if they do that, then they won't be able to use them again to destabilize the area and to benefit Israel. And if we were to look at the Oded Inan plan for Greater Israel, it actually states in there that it's imperative that they're going to be using the Kurds to help divide the neighboring countries. Now, the Kurds have also, in Turkey, back in 1914 to 1923, they were committing genocide against Christian minority groups, including the Assyrians, the Armenians. And then a lot of those Assyrians and Armenians, when they fled Turkey, they went to Syria and they established the city called El Kamishli, which now, interestingly enough, the Syrian Kurds are saying that that's now the capital of their Rojava or Hova, you know. So they have been in this position before. This is not a unique position for them to be in, but the surprising part is that they keep, you know, allowing themselves to be used in this way with hopes that, you know, that they're going to get their independent Kurdistan. But for anyone that's looked at the history, they've seen that, you know, that's not really something that the U.S. or Israel or, you know, their allies really want them to have. Now, with Israel, they benefit from them, and they've had a really long relationship together. I mean, for the past 50 years or so, Israel has been training some of their top security officials and, you know, mentoring them and such. And these relationships kind of just surfaced, the information about them surfaced just recently. But so they've had a long relationship there. Hmm. So, they're finding themselves in the same position that they were multiple times before.
Okay. Now, can you address the portrayals we've seen from the Kurdish advocates as they're gender egalitarian and democratic and inclusive? You know, that seems to be, and also they have a long-standing reputation as a persecuted minority. I'm wondering if you might have any comments about those portrayals.
Absolutely. The media has portrayed them in such a positive way. They've romanticized them. They've basically made them out to be these, wonderful warriors against Daesh, and that they're the best. They refer to them as, you know, the best fighters against Daesh. And that whole image is PR. It's just public relations. It's just to garner support for the U.S. to support them. Now, what the U.S. did was in October of 2015, they established the Syrian Democratic Forces, okay? And what that basically was is they took the YPG, who is the military branch of the PYD, which is the Kurdish group in Syria, and they basically told them, you know, we're going to need you to rebrand yourself. We're going to need you to come up with a new name, because your name right now is associated with the PKK, which is a known terrorist group by the U.S. and Turkey. And the PKK is located, they're located in Turkey. So the YPG came up with, you know, this new name, Syrian Democratic Forces. And it's almost comical, because in a July interview with a U.S. commander, he was asked, or actually I think it was the April interview, he was asked, what percentage are Arabs in the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces? And he said 20%. So that's an indication right there that, you know, what they're trying to portray is that this is a group that, you know, is made up of Syrians and, even some Christian minorities and Kurds, and that they're all there just to fight, you know, Daesh. But the majority of them are Kurds, okay, and they have their ties to the PKK. So they're no different than the PKK. They're just the Syrian offshoot. Now, as far as persecution and, you know, what they claim, I mean, it's kind of interesting that they keep saying these different things, that they've been mistreated and such, while at the same time, they're actually mistreating Syrians and Christian minorities in Syria, okay? They've been carrying out these ethnic cleansing missions, basically in Raqqa and in other areas. And the sole mission of that is to change the demographics so that in these areas that were predominantly, you know, Arab or Christian, now that they've been driven out of their homes and their homes have been confiscated, the Kurds move in and they now say, okay, now we're the majority, so we're going to take this land, this area, we've liberated it, it's now part of ours, and they're going to try to use that as a bargaining tool. So the Kurds, I mean, we just have to keep in mind that in Syria, they're only 7 to 10% of the whole population, and in the northeast, they're only about 30 to 40% of the population, yet they want to claim that area, okay, and that's the most agriculturally rich and oil-rich area, which supports the rest of the country. So other Syrians are, you know, supposed to be supported by that as well, but they want to just claim that to be, you know, part of their own area. They originally had come from, they came in waves around the 1920s, and then multiple times afterwards from Turkey, where they were being, you know, persecuted there, or, you know, they had some issues there. The Syrian government, their main mission is they just want unity. They want the country to be for all Syrians, whereas the Kurds, you know, the separatist Kurds, I just want to make sure that everyone understands that whenever we say Kurds, we're not talking about the entire ethnicity. They're not one monolithic group. They are, there are 30 million people who have, you know, they speak different languages, they have different religions, they have different political views. Some identify as being, you know, Kurdish. Others identify as being Iraqi or Syrian or Iranian or Turkish, first and foremost, okay? So they're not one group that we can kind of lump in together. But as far as the separatist group, the separatist Kurds, you know, they've been, in addition to driving out Arabs and Christians from their homes, they're forcing the young men and some young women to join the SDF. And they're also enforcing their Kurdish curriculum on schools. And there's a number of schools that have been closed, and the principals and teachers have been locked up because they wouldn't teach, you know, the Kurdish curriculum. They're also enforcing all these different taxes and rules. And their police division, they're called the Eshaish, they've been harassing non-Kurds. And a really important point that, you know, I've made before, and I want to make again here on your show, is that they've actually also worked, or, you know, with Daesh and other terrorist groups. I mean, so that kind of alone, I would think, negates the whole idea of them being these revolutionary, upright, you know.
How have they worked with Daesh?
You know. Well, in certain parts, what they've done is, I guess they've given them notice that they're going to be coming into that area, and then Daesh just surrender, and then they join their forces. So they just surrender and they join their forces. They've actually done this in Iraq. They've done it in Syria in multiple places. And, you know, what's alarming is you would think that they would put up a fight, but even some of the Daesh members and, you know, who have defected, they've said that we were told not to kill the SDF. We were told, you know, to surrender to them. You know, in Iraq, they were told to surrender to them, the Peshmerga, rather than the Iraqi government, the Iraqi armed forces. And in Syria, we're seeing them also, you know, basically either leaving the area, and also actually at one point, the Kurds we saw, and this was a video that was taken by, I think, RT or one of the Russian media outlets. It was a video of a whole convoy of trucks that were filled with Daesh members that were just passing through while, you know, an SDF area. And SDF just, you know, the Kurds, they just let them pass through. So they've definitely worked together. And also with the Free Syrian Army and other terrorist groups. So, you know, you can't really say that you're fighting them, but you're also working with them. This all goes into the whole PR thing. You know, their PR image, their media image is a lot different than what's happening on the ground. And that's where I get my information, is on the ground from Syrians and from actually even Kurds that are against what they're seeing, you know, other Kurds doing. And they're speaking up too, but they're being told not to, and they've been silenced a number of times. So now, you know, that's something that we're seeing, is that the image that they're portraying is different. I mean, on TV, I think I've seen a couple of like little clips and such and advertisements where they had like the women, okay, and they were saying that, you know, these are Kurdish female fighters. Well, the Syrian army has female fighters. They have a female division. The Syriac Soturo in the northeast, okay, they're Orthodox Christian. They have their own women's division as well. So there's different, but you're not going to see those. You're only going to see the Peshmerga and the YPG, you know, women soldiers. What they don't want you to see, however, is what's going on with Turkey, with the PKK, and actually even with the YPG, where they are actually kidnapping you know, Kurdish children and turning them into child soldiers, and, you know, or forcing them to fight with them. And that those are some things that you don't see. Also recently in Syria, they've been putting up like flags of Öcalan, who is the leader of the PKK. So they're not even trying to hide right now the association between the YPG and the PKK. And again, the PKK, we know, is a terrorist. They're considered a terrorist organization.
Mm.
So
how, I just wanted to ask, you know, how would you describe Kurdish allegiance with the U.S., you know, in light of what you were saying earlier? I mean, is this a one of genuine solidarity, or is it a maybe a cynical and temporary alliance of convenience?
I think from the U.S. side, it's solely, you know, for them to carry out a mission for the U.S., okay, to destabilize the area or to create, you know, and because they have a number of bases now in Syria as well, like a number of them in the northeast, and I think there's a couple in the south as well. So the U.S., they see them as, you know what, we're able to stay in this area in Syria as long as we have the, you know, the YPG in control of the area. And now we have eyes and ears on Iran, okay, and we can protect Israel. So for them, it's just, what can they get out of the deal? I mean, on both sides, it's basically that, you know. But now with the Kurds, what they're thinking, I think, is that, okay, since the U.S. is arming us and funding us and training us and, you know, really helping us out, they must support our independence or at least our demands for autonomy or for us to control these oil-rich, agriculturally rich areas. And, you know, we're going to have to see how that plays out. But if it's anything like what has historically happened, then we're going to see that the U.S. is going to pull out whenever the Kurds have fulfilled their mission. So we're going to have to see how that goes. Now, the Syrian government, they've even said that once Daesh is defeated, they're willing to sit down with the Kurds and come to some sort of an agreement. But it has to be within the parameters of the Syrian constitution. They're not going to be able to give them an autonomous area, probably not even a federation, but they're going to try to come to some sort of an agreement with them. And at the same time, President Assad did say that he wanted to, you know, liberate every inch of Syria. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. Now, as far as in Iraq, we saw with the September 25th, the Barzani Kurdish referendum, which was universally opposed, and that was led by the KRG. Now, what we saw there was, I think the Kurds had expected that the U.S. would kind of go in and back them up and be there for them. And when they saw that, you know, Trump was saying, we're not taking a side, even though they were pretty much arming both sides, they have armed both sides. But when they said they're not going to take a side, a lot of, you know, Kurds did get upset. And there were demonstrations where they were, you know, hurling a lot of different anti-American sentiments. And they were saying things like death for America. And what's important to, and this is when Kirkuk was basically taken back by the Iraqi armed forces. And it was in a disputed area. So it never, it didn't belong, so to speak, to the Kurds. But it was theirs temporarily because they had liberated it from Daesh a couple of years ago. But now when they took it back, the Kurds did get a little upset. But the crazy thing is that before they had this referendum, they actually had more freedom. After the referendum, you know, their airports were shut down. I believe the banking system, the media, everything was now.
Yeah, the
Iraqi government was trying to now control it because, you know, and they had a semi-autonomous region. So they were trying to go from semi-autonomous to, you know, fully autonomous and not going through, you know, the Iraqi constitution. But they did come out yesterday and say that they want to do a ceasefire. They want to freeze the results of the referendum and that they are now open to dialogue based on the Iraqi constitution. So that's good. And Israel was really upset about them losing Kirkuk because of the oil, the very oil-rich area. So, So, I mean, basically, the main point, though, is that this whole idea of Kurdish independence, and this kind of goes back to what you're asking about the PR, it's a very ethnocentric, chauvinistic idea, okay? Something like this would be considered in the U.S. to be racist or, it would be frowned upon. Yet a lot of Americans somehow feel that, they feel sympathy and they feel like, oh, well, these are a prosecuted people and they deserve to have their own land. The land that they're claiming, they never owned it. They don't have any legitimate or legal or historical, ties to this land. They have migrated. They're nomadic. They really do not like for that word to be used. But even if you look at what the word Kurd means, it basically does mean nomad. And they refer to, I think it was about 200 different tribes, okay, that came out of Iran. They refer to all of those as Kurds. So anyone that was a nomadic group, that's what their name was. So now, for them to now say that, okay, we want to establish this whole region, this whole country, okay, for ourselves, which takes a part of four different countries, okay, you got Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. They want to take a portion of these four countries and establish their own country. What about the people that live in those areas? In northeast Syria, for instance, the Syrians, the Assyrians, the Armenians, all these different minority groups and the Arabs, why are they now going to be treated as second-class citizens in that country so that one group could get autonomy or, get their independence? Other groups are now going to suffer. And a very interesting thing that I've noticed is especially with anarchists is that they're very much against the idea of big states. They prefer little statelets or no borders, right? Mm-hmm. But when it comes to Kurdistan and Kurds, they're for, they are supporting their idea of establishing their own state. So how are they against Syria, okay, being its own sovereign country? They're against, they don't see a problem with Syria being broken up into smaller statelets, okay? And at the same time, they want to see Kurdistan establish their own country. So it's a contradiction, and it makes absolutely no sense. And they're basically putting all the facts, a lot of things that I've mentioned, to you right now, they're putting all those on the side and saying, no, you know what? These people need their own land. They're not monolithic, okay? They have different languages. They have different sects of religion. So they're not one united group that all want the same thing. And that's the main thing that I think a lot of people need to understand.
Okay.
And they've also, done quite a bit of persecution and such, which they're claiming was done against them, but they've done it as well. So,
Well, I think we're going to have to close it there, but I want to really thank you for sharing your perspectives with us. And I'll just remind our listeners that you can find Sarah Abed's articles on her site, www.sarahabed.com. Sarah Abed is a Syrian-American independent investigative political commentator, and you can also find more of her articles on globalresearch.ca. Thanks again, Sarah Abed.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me. Take care.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Well, we are joined through Skype by Mark Taliano, and we're going to be speaking about Syria, and in particular, his book, Voices from Syria, which has just come out this year. Mark Taliano is a former high school teacher, an author and an independent investigative reporter, as well as a research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization. In September of 2016, Mark traveled to Syria, and where he was able to corroborate some of his own research into the Syrian conflict and the distortions of reality presented in mainstream and some alternative media discourse. And so Mark Taliano is joining us from Hamilton. So welcome, Mark Taliano.
Hi, Michael. Nice to be with you. I've seen some of your shows. I really enjoy them.
Just to start, when you started to question the official account of Syria and what's been going on there, can I ask, you know, maybe where you started to have doubts about the official story, maybe what your sources of information were?
Well, I'd read a lot of Michel Chassudowski's book, but certainly people should have remembered all the lies as fake pretext to the war on Iraq. And so it seemed quite clear that the same thing was going on in Syria. And I think that people would see it as clearly as that if they would turn off the television and not read the newspapers, which is asking a lot.
Mark, could I ask you to maybe share a particular anecdote? I mean, you were there in September.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there's something that could really impress on our listeners just the extent of the ordeal that they endured.
Every story that's in the book is really horrible. Lily Martin is and then the other thing here is, I mean, Lily Martin, for example, who's in my book, and I use some of her testimonies, and I always corroborate all the testimonies. She's a permanent resident in Syria, but she's also an American citizen. And so the U.S. Empire has citizens living in Syria who have to withstand this. And so this comes from Lily Martin, permanent resident in Syria, who happens to also be an American citizen. And this is what happened. She writes about why she could not vote for Hillary Clinton. And this is what she said. She personally oversaw, she meaning Hillary Clinton, she personally oversaw the transfer of weapons from Libya to Turkey to be used specifically by the American-backed terrorists who destroyed my own home on March 21st, 2014 and beheaded my Christian neighbors and raped the old ladies who they kidnapped and took to Turkey and killed others and destroyed the whole village of Kassab, Syria. This is not a rumor. This is a fact, Lily writes. This is well documented in her time as Secretary of State. So what Lily, I mean, it's disgusting, but every single story that I heard is disgusting. That's the story. I mean, that's just one of many, many, many stories that these people have to endure thanks to us, thanks to the West, thanks to the NATO terrorists. And what Lily is referring to there is the weapons rat line from Libya early in the war. The weapons rat line that came from Libya's looted armories all the way to Syria. Hmm. And some people think that that's part of the reason why Libya was destroyed. And it probably was. That's one of many reasons, and every reason was a bad reason.
I know that Aleppo had been occupied for some time by the al-Nusra and ISIS forces, and a lot of people were forced, basically kidnapped, and not allowed to escape. Did you hear any reports from out of there?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, in Aleppo was liberated, and then all sorts of evidence came out that confirmed what documentation has confirmed, which is all these terrorists, they're just one and the same. They're all Al-Qaeda affiliates. They're all linked to Al-Qaeda, including ISIS. And for example, you had the FSA, you had Daesh, you had all sorts of different groups coming together in a part of Aleppo that they occupied, and they worked together. and they hoarded medicine that was, you know, given to them from our governments, and they hoarded food, and they launched ordnance filled with explosives and nails and poison gas regularly, all the time, into the parts of Aleppo that were not occupied. And when people tried to leave through these corridors, which the terrorists mined, they were shot. So people couldn't leave. They were totally captive. And all sorts of coercive methods were used to have these people trained basically as slaves. Do what we say or we kill you, literally. And the terrorists, as policy, they use hospitals, they occupy hospitals, and they, because those, typically because they're very solid buildings, but also they're protected. And we've seen all the public relations about that. But they occupy hospitals, they get their medicines there, and they create jail cells in the hospital building, and they put victims in the jail cells, and they torture them there, and they execute people, and they have sniper posts perched on the top of the hospitals often. So these hospitals are used as command posts, as torture centers, Sharia law courts. That's where they hoard food and medicine. That's often the base from which these terrorists operate. And the rest of the Aleppo population is captive. Yeah. Like the occupied parts of say East Aleppo, the occupied parts where the terrorists, they didn't occupy all of Aleppo, they weren't able to do so, but the parts that they did occupy, the people didn't want them there. And the people were captive. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't hear these stories, and all these stories are corroborated by numerous sources.
Amnesty International, Médecins Sans Frontières, Avaz have been very, very on top of that anti-Assad campaign. I was wondering if you could try to account for people who hold those entities in such high esteem. I mean, how do you explain to them that these accounts are inaccurate, and how do you make sense of that?
This is the new way that empire works. They corrupt agencies. Now, none of these so-called non-governmental agencies are non-governmental. They're all governmental. They're funded by the government and foundations. And there's a revolving door often between the board of directors and the State Department. For example, Susan Nossel was with the U.S. government, and then she transferred over to Amnesty International. So all these and all these groups, they are an appendage of empire because they are embedded with the terrorists, and that includes the White Helmets. The White Helmets are actually Al Qaeda.
Yeah,
and that's hard for a lot of people to swallow, especially since the White Helmets won an Oscar. Vanessa Bealey's done a wonderful work for this. So what we have here is this whole complex of non-governmental agencies, Amnesty International, Avaz. They're all governmental. They're all embedded with the terrorists, and they're supported by foundation money as well. And they are the source for our mainstream media stories.
I'm really astonished by the extent to which the left and the anti-war movement has been corrupted. I mean, I know that. I mean, astonishingly enough, like you, at the outset, you talked about Iraq, and my sense was that there was broad opposition to the Iraq war, and this is only 2 years or less than 2 years after 9/11, and now there's hardly any anti-war campaign against Syria in sight. So it's really quite remarkable. I mean, is there anything more you could say about this, extent to which the success of this interference, this confusion within Syria solidarity circles.
It is really astonishing because, as you said, Iraq, there were huge protests. I think this is unprecedented. The amount of lies about the war on Syria, I think, is basically unprecedented. Prof. Tim Anderson would agree. He wrote a book on it as well. I think we have to address these taboo topics, including 9/11. Because after 9/11, this war on terror, which is a war for terror, literally, all of these invasions have accelerated. Afghanistan didn't attack us, and Afghanistan was attacked. I mean, none of these countries attacked us. Now the truth is coming out, but it's been coming out for 7 years. But now that liberated areas are, you know, now that the devastation is there and some of us are on the ground, Vanessa Bealey, Eva Bartlett, Tim Anderson, Janice Kortkamp, I was there and I hope to go back. We're taking pictures. There's people on the ground right now. Janice is there. Tim is there. And they see these huge arsenals of weaponry, all NATO weaponry that ISIS and the other terrorists left behind in their rush to leave. So the evidence, primary source evidence, is overwhelming.
A couple of familiar talking points that's adding to the confusion on the anti-imperialist left. For one thing, as you recall, Maher Arar was sent to rendition to Syria, where he was tortured. So that's one thing that a lot of activists are mindful of. There is also this idea of the Arab Spring and the Daraa in Daraa, where there was this major uprising, and apparently or supposedly the Syrian armed forces attacked peaceful protesters. So I'm wondering if, just before we kind of close this discussion, if you'd like to address those two.
Yeah, well, it was an intelligence operation from the beginning. It's similar to these. So what happened in Daraa is, as I mentioned earlier, the weapons were already there. They had weapons. It's an intelligence operation. And people were protesting in Syria, as they do in other countries, peacefully. There were polls done from both sides, and they didn't want violence. The people did not want violence. But as was the case with Ukraine, and as was the case with other so-called uprisings, militants were inserted into it, and they would provoke violence, and they would shoot at police. And the police, people won't believe this, but the police were ordered to not carry arms. Okay, they were, and the police were being slaughtered. And this is well documented in the book. So we have outsiders coming in, instigating violence to create a fake revolution.
Could you address the point about Maher Arar and thought feelings, how that colors people's thinking about Assad?
Well, okay, so the empire tortures people all over the world, but they like to work, CIA likes to work beneath the mantle of plausible deniability. So they would often outsource the torture. So this ties in with the Arar story, where the torture is outsourced. Now bear in mind that the empire, it can be very, very coercive. If a country such as Syria stands up to the empire and says, no, we don't want this. No, we resist your overtures. No, we do not want ISIS, Al-Qaeda to govern us. The empire can be very, very coercive. They have a whole raft of, they have these mercenaries, and they destroy countries that stand up to empire. They destroy Libya, Iraq, Ukraine, and so on and so forth. So if the empire demands, well, guess what? I want you to torture so-and-so, that can be pretty coercive.
Okay. Well, Mark, I think we got to leave it there, but I just want to remind folks again that the book is Voices from Syria, just published earlier this year. You can purchase it from the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. Thank you again for agreeing to this interview.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be speaking with you.
His name is Mark Taliano, and he is a author and independent investigative reporter. He joined us from Hamilton, Ontario. In Canada, speakers and activists who have attempted to challenge mainstream narratives of a Syrian civil war between a moderate, pro-democracy opposition and a brutal Assad regime have encountered significant opposition even from within left progressive circles, and critical pro-interventionist Syrian Canadians are playing a role. To give us more details about the obstacles plaguing the Syrian solidarity movement, we're joined from Toronto by Majd Zuda. She is a PhD candidate in science education at the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education at the University of Toronto. She was born in Kuwait but moved to Damascus in 2005, where she lived until 2012 before moving to Canada. She still has family in Damascus that she visits annually. So, Majd Zuda, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. It's my pleasure.
Now, could you maybe talk about some of the... I'll just give you a little bit of my background. I had actually helped to organize a visit by Ava Bartlett, and in Winnipeg in February, and I just put the message out. I contacted an Islamic group that I know, and just had them put the word out. And I guess within about 48 hours, I got 5 emails saying that this was very disrespectful and that I should cancel the event. So I'm not used to that. Okay, I mean, I've encountered resistance to activism before, but nothing like that. Do you have any? And they claim to be of the Syrian diaspora. Do you have any insights into who these people are that are from the anti-Assad, pro-interventionist Syrians?
Okay. Thank you for that, Michael. I would like to say one thing here about this resistance, which we faced it from Syrian who are claiming that they are opposing President Assad because he's a dictator and because they wanted freedom for the Syrian people. And yet, if you dare to say anything that doesn't agree in any way in whatever they're claiming, they will immediately point their finger aggressively and they will accuse you of being supporting dictator, brutal, or whatever it is, and they will try to stop you from saying your perspective in all possible ways, which I found it very strange for people who are actually claiming that they are supporting freedom and at the same time they suppress other people's opinion. How can I describe that? I think we contend that there are opposition from wide varieties, but for those specifically that they are becoming more aggressive, we find that a lot of people who are from the fundamentalist perspective are very active in that direction. And even when I was living in Syria in the beginning of the very, very beginning of the war, some of the groups that went out claiming that or opposing President Assad and the Syrian government, their main motive was to kick out the Christian out of the country and also to send Alawi to the grave. So from the very beginning, their motives were very sectarian. They don't accept other people's opinions. They have their own view that they want to impose on the Syrian people, which is very secular and very diverse. And I believe a lot of those people came here, especially probably from the Muslim Brotherhood. They came here as refugees, even before the Syrian war started in 2011. And because they were in, they had a lot of troubles in Syria. They committed violent events in Syria during the 70s, late 70s, beginning of the 80s. And
because the Syrian government was taking a strict procedure against them, many of them probably asked for to be refugees in different parts of the world, and I think there's a big part of them here in Canada, and probably they could be one of the group that they are trying to resist and to stop your work.
So there's a large number of people who came here as refugees who are these fundamentalists and Muslim Brotherhood. I don't know if there's much distinction between the two. But I mean, were they coming in different streams, or were they, I mean, were they all, was there just a large influx of people, and you know, you have the secular people, say more like yourself, mixed in with these individuals?
You mean the who came in refugees after the 2011 or before that?
Well, I guess I'm thinking of the people who have been most vocal in recent years. I mean, have they been here for, many, many years, or did they just come in here over the last, maybe 7-8 years or so?
I think some of them have been here like a long time, and they have like a strong opposition on fuel since long time, like even before 2011. And probably they have participated in a way in what's happening in Syria, or by supporting fundamentalist groups in Syria. But I think also, I believe, and this is my perspective, again, I cannot, from what I saw, I believe that a lot of them came during the refugee, but not all of them. Like, there are a lot of refugees who are like secular. There are some refugees who came after 2011 who are really suffering, because they are really suffering from the war that happened in Syria. I'm not here as a refugee. I came as an immigrant skilled worker. So there are like the refugees who are coming here after 2011. There are wide spectrum, but I think that there are big part of them with a fundamentalist view.
Could you comment?
This is my impression, because most of the people came from camps in Jordan and in Lebanon and in Turkey. And we know that a lot of people who went to the camps are from the opposition with the fundamentalist views. Again, not all of them, definitely not all of them. And some of them were just like running away of the war and like the conflict that's happening there. But we also, as a Syrian, as a person who lived in Syria and had family in Syria, I have the impression that a lot of people in the camp come with a fundamentalist view.
Interesting. Now, you're based in Toronto. Can you comment? I just shared a little bit of the story from Winnipeg vantage point. Could you share any stories things that you've experienced in Toronto in terms of disruption and whatnot?
I haven't encountered personally one of those. I remember when we tried to attend Eva Bartlett's event here in Toronto. She said the story about being like her event being tried to be sabotaged, and like they couldn't book a place to have the event. They found difficulties in doing that. This is one incident that I heard about. The other thing which I noticed, that in the media and in the event, like for example, many film festivals that happen in Toronto, it's not only one perspective of the Syrian conflict that is usually presented, which is that the Syrian government and President Assad is a brutal dictator, which is not the truth at all. And there is no representation to any other perspective of whatever happened in Syria. And even if you try to reach to the media, and I think one of our colleagues, Lulwa, was trying to reach the media and to talk to them and try to have an interview where she can speak her mind and like tell about the other perspective of what's happening in Syria. But unfortunately, she couldn't have any access to that.
Another thing that I experienced was I'd reached out to some of the progressive left groups that I'm acquainted with, and I was rather shocked by the resistance that I encountered. And the few groups that did show support for the Eva Bartlett event, they didn't want to be publicly acknowledged. Does that sound familiar to you in terms of, you know, trying to relate to the anti-war, anti-imperialist left?
I mean, again, I won't say that. How can I say? I think it's a problem about, like, the problem that I mentioned about, like, you cannot say any, like, it seems that you cannot say any opposite opinion or to express it loudly, because you will be accused in, immediately, and fingers will be pointed at you. I was in one event when I was, like, it was an anti-Assad event, and I was trying to say that this is not what's happening. And I remember the two couple, and like, what are you saying? Are you defending Assad? And they said, yes, he's not like that. And they immediately, like, look at me as if I'm a murderer or a monster, and they went, like, move away. And I think this is one main issue when you cannot, like, express, the, like, how would you know the truth if you cannot, or, like, know what's going there if you cannot hear from all different perspectives?
Hmm. I'm wondering if maybe just in closing, you can talk a little bit about how you see the anti-Assad Syrians and other individuals, how they are continuing to sabotage any conversation, any possibility of unity among the Syrian people.
I mean, like, just recently we had, I don't know if you knew about our national football team was playing to get to the World Cup. And in the team, there are players who are pro-Syrian government and pro-President Assad. And we know that there are, like, some people who were against the Syrian government and against President Assad, and they were called into to play in the national team. And it seems that unite, like, this made a unity between a lot of Syrian people who were, like, divided. But still, there were people, especially with fundamentalist perspective, who were, like, very angry about what happened, and they tried to advertise that. They tried to advertise it as in a negative way. So even anyway, like, in any way that can bring the Syrian people together and, like, make any possibilities for conversation, for celebrating, it's been perceived as a negative event, and it's tried to be stop in a way. Not stop, like, either advertise in a negative way or in some cases sabotage.
Hmm. Well, Maj Zuda, I really want to thank you for sharing your insights, and thank you for coming on and speaking your truth. It seems to be rare, a rare perspective, unfortunately, in the media these days. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate that. So you give us, again, the possibility to say something other than you hear in the mainstream media, and to just give some insight about what's going there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
We've been joined by Maj Zuda. She is a Toronto-based PhD candidate in science education at the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education at the University of Toronto, and she is a member of the Syrian diaspora in Canada.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.